Hello, this is Dr. Michael McGee. Welcome to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. We have as our guest today Dr. Alexandra Katahakis. She is the founder and clinical director of the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles. Welcome, Dr. Katahakis.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're going to be talking today about sexual addiction and about understanding addiction as affect dysregulation. So we're really excited to have you. I see that you've had multiple awards that you've been given for your work and multiple books that you have written over the years on sexual addiction and on rekindling healthy sex in the aftermath of sexual addiction. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this work?
Sure. Well, I started being interested in human sexuality in graduate school because in graduate school, as in many programs, you're sort of immersing yourself in a topic. In this case, it was psychology, but everyone's looking for the thing that most lights them up, I suppose. And I had a human sexuality class in which I just fell in love with the ideas about sexual health and sexual pleasure and what it means to be sexually active over a lifetime, especially with the extension of our lifetimes today, where people are living into their 80s and 90s with, you know, good regularity as opposed to dying when they were 30 or 40. And so I started looking for a paid internship is really what happened, and the only one I could find related to sex and sexuality was treating sexual addiction, because at that time it was 1997, 98. And Dr. Patrick Carnes had just left Del Amo Hospital here in Southern California, where he had installed yet another sexual disorders program in the hospital, and they were treating specifically sex addiction, which I'd never heard of before. And then I read his book, Out of the Shadows, and started working in an agency that was solely treating people that identified as sexually addicted, which it was sort of a this fringy idea about problematic sexual behavior at that time. So that's really how I got into the field of sex addiction.
Oh, fascinating. You know, we've been hearing about sex addiction for a long time now. It's still not recognized, as I understand it, by the American Psychological Association. Is this a real psychiatric or psychological problem? What do you think about that?
Well, it's safe to say now that the World Health Organization is recognizing it as a bona fide problem. And they are, you know, the diagnosis is compulsive sexual behavior disorder, I believe, is the diagnosis that they have approved and that will be in the new version of the ICD, which is now the ICD-11, going forward. And so it has been recognized also by the American Society of Addiction Medicine as being a behavioral addiction in the same ways that food can be and gambling could be, because sexual addiction shares a lot of the same features of gambling disorder, for example, and certainly pornography addiction shares probably almost identical features to gambling, because it's intermittent reward. It's all, you know, through a computer. These images are highly activating to the brain and to the nervous system in ways that can become compulsive and addictive for people. So increasingly, we see more and more 12-step organizations across the globe dedicated to problems of sexual addiction and compulsivity. And certainly, we have over 2,000 certified sex addiction therapists in the country treating the problem. And people are coming in stating that they have the problem. So I think probably the DSM is going to quickly be behind the times because of the argument that goes on in the academic world. And that argument can go on, but people are suffering and struggling with these compulsive and problematic sexual behaviors.
If you have somebody who, let's say, is using masturbating to pornography on the Internet, and at what point does that be, what is the definition of a sexual addiction, and how does one determine whether or not one's sexuality or sexual behavior is an addiction or not?
Well, there are some distinct criteria that have been looked at, you know, through peer-reviewed journals and things of that nature, but just kind of in general, just to give your listeners an idea, you know, one of the first things we know with any addiction is what is your level of preoccupation? So in other words, how often are you thinking about either getting into the experience or, you know, getting into or acquiring the substance, so whether it's alcohol or drugs, or you're thinking about getting into the sexual experience or when you're going to gamble next, that amount of time that it takes where people are thinking about it constantly is one of the first criteria for any behavioral addiction. So what is your level of preoccupation? And that's a good start for people. Then there's also the matter of, you know, what kind of messes or problems is it causing in the person's life? You know, do they have what we call unmanageability in their life as a result of engaging in the problem so often? There's also a reported loss of control where people are doing more than they wish they wanted to or more than they intended to do. And we all know the feeling of saying, oh, I'm just going to check email for 3 minutes and then 45 minutes has gone by. And, you know, so that's an example of the ways we can lose track of time. But when somebody's constantly feeling like they're out of control and doing more of something than they want, whether it's eating, shopping, gambling, or sex, then they want to take a look at that. There's also a pattern of out-of-control behavior over time. So this is not something that just happens one or two times. It's something that's been changing over time, and the person has made repeated specific attempts to stop the behavior, and they can't. They keep failing over and over again. And we hear this from many addicts in recovery, as you well know, that people try and try to stop on their own, and they can't. Because if somebody doesn't have a problem, they'll say, I'm not going to do that anymore, and they don't. There's also loss of time, which I alluded to earlier, you know, significant amounts of time lost doing or recovering from the behavior. People complain about that a lot. Their work starts to fail. Actually, those messes and the unmanageability comes as a result of how much time is spent preparing for and getting into the sexual behavior, whether it's online looking for escort sites or someone to hook up with or going to strip clubs or sex clubs or being on webcams, things of that nature. And then on the back end, there's a lot of time spent covering up their tracks. And so that will lead to an inability to fulfill obligations because these behaviors interfere with people's work, school, families, and friends. And then there's a continuation despite negative consequences. So the person cannot stop the behavior even though they've had problems. They might have legal problems, financial problems. Maybe they lost a job from it. And they're still in denial about, you know, what's happening to them. There's also escalation. So like any addiction, the person needs to make their behavior more intense, more frequent, more risky, something in order to get the same sort of high they were getting before. And then there's withdrawal. For many people, stopping a behavior that's compulsive is going to create considerable distress, like anxiety or restlessness or irritability or inability to sleep, some kind of discomfort. So all of that will lead to losses, as I spoke about before. Things that people really value, they will lose as a result of this problem being front row and center and taking up so much time, energy, money, and space. So that gives you a general idea of the, quote, criteria.
That was a wonderful overview of addiction. Just to review, you mentioned preoccupation, problematic behaviors as a result of sexual behavior, loss of control, compulsion, a pattern of out-of-control behavior over time, repeated attempts to stop and not being able to do so, the loss of time for doing other productive things, and continuation of sexual behavior despite negative consequences, and then you mentioned sort of tolerance and withdrawal. Thank you so much for that excellent definition. Let me ask you, how come you wrote a book and I want to make sure that I have this right. Tell us about you wrote a book on sort of the neurobiological, psychological perspective about addiction and this idea of neurobiological dysregulation. Can you tell us a little bit about your book and your thinking about that?
Sure. Well, the book is called Sex Addiction as Affect Dysregulation, because when I first started doing the work, as we talked about earlier, the model was a medical model, and it was a cognitive behavioral model. So it was very directive. It was about stopping the behavior and changing one's thoughts, which is sort of the classic addiction model for helping people get sober, get abstinent. And it's great for drugs and alcohol because you don't ever have to use drugs and alcohol to have a happy, balanced life. But you do have to have sex to have a healthy, balanced life. And when I was really, you know, working in this field in a way where I was seeing clients over and over and over again, something wasn't lining up for me. I realized there was more to this than just the behavior and the thoughts. The question, well, what was driving all of that? And in the about 10 years ago now, actually 12 years ago now, in the mid-2000s, I met Dr. Alan Shore, who is a neuropsychoanalyst and was very instrumental in the large attachment conference at UCLA here in Los Angeles. And I started going to those conferences, and everybody was talking about attachment theory, meaning they were examining early developmental neuroscience and looking at the absolute essential needs of the infant related to the primary caregiver or the mother for survival. And this is not about gender politics. This is evolutionary and biological directives that if an infant does not have classically a mother, that doesn't mean that same-sex couples can't, quote, mother an infant, but a primary caregiver that is making a high level of contact with that infant appropriately over time. The first 18 to 4 months to 4 years are crucial for infant development. So in other words, if the mother's not making eye contact, if she's not responding contingently through tone of voice, through touch, through gesture, through, you know, skin-to-skin conversation, in all the ways that we know that mothers and infants communicate, then that infant is going to be set up for problems down the road. So, for example, if you have a mother who's depressed or anxious, who's grief-stricken because she has postpartum depression, or she's in a violent relationship or alcoholic relationship, any number of things that would impinge on her capacity to be fully present for that infant's going to suffer because he or she desperately needs the mother's input in order to mature and grow. It's a requirement for the right brain and the autonomic nervous system to have these nonverbal cues coming in contingently for the baby to be tended to all of its needs, in order for its brain and nervous system to form in what we would call a secure way. And so what I saw and realized working with all the patients I was working with is that they had come from families where they didn't get that. And in fact, in 1991, Patrick Carnes did a study where he showed that I think it was like 80 to 90% of all sex addicts came from emotionally abusive families. And certainly some were physically and sexually abusive and also terribly neglected, what he called rigid and disengaged. And with that, we knew subsequent to that, or simultaneous to that really, the ACEs study, that, you know, these things impact the human organism greatly. So I started to put all that together and recognize that all addicts, and specifically sex addicts, struggle with affect dysregulation, and they use sex in order to regulate their nervous systems, whether it's to bring them up out of dead states or depressive states, or to create more excitatory states for whatever reason. They're seeking excitation, and we know that that's a dopamine-seeking proposition. But they're using sex to manage their mood or to, you know, manage or shift their own neurochemistry. And so that's really was my contribution to Patrick Carne's work, where his work stopped as a cognitive behavioral model. My work started to weave into his model, looking deeper over time at what got the person there to begin with.
Right. So what you're saying is that because of trauma of either abuse or neglect, that people develop they don't go through a healthy elaboration of their emotional relational system so that they can make secure, healthy attachments to others. Because ultimately, the primary way that we regulate how we feel is through our relationships with others, right?
Correct, especially when we are secure and we are, yes, balanced. That's
right.
The primary way. If you're a drug addict, you use drugs, alcohol, sex, something else.
Right. So people are just trying to feel good and not feel bad, and they can't, they have, because of their attachment disorders, because of their trauma and neglect, they're not able to use intimate, close, loving relationships and connectedness to regulate how they feel. And so then they fall into some sort of addiction to feel better, a way of numbing pain with pleasure, if you will. So let me ask you, how is it that people fall into sex addiction versus, say, other addictions? What are the particular vulnerabilities of a person that they might become more vulnerable to sex addiction versus, say, food addiction or cocaine or some other addiction?
Some of it, I think, is intergenerationally transmitted. I think we know that there's an alcoholic gene. And I think when somebody grows up in a family where the only thing they have available to them is masturbation to soothe themselves, they learn really early on that through orgasm, they'll feel better. It will make the pain or the scariness go away. And now we live in a highly pornographied culture and one in which pornography is incredibly available to kids of all ages, that kids can reach for this very, very quickly now. I mean, especially we're seeing this in what's called Gen Z. Gen Z are the people that grew up with internet pornography, or they've grown up on the internet, let's put it that way. They've only ever had cell phones and pads from the time they were born. And that cohort in general, I think something like 14% report having looked at porn between the ages of 12 and 14 years old. And there are statistics that are showing that the earliest or the average age that kids are looking at porn for the first time is 8. So that in and of itself can start to lead somebody down a road of using sex compulsively.
So you're saying a genetic component perhaps or just sort of the particular vulnerability to orgasm making you feel better or quelling the loneliness or emptiness or whatever pain you're having. But you're also pointing out the importance of the widespread exposure to this the stimulus of pornography, which is perhaps maybe a little bit different, people having a little bit younger exposure now than perhaps they did 100 years ago.
Oh, well, much more exposure, I would say, because, you know, there was a article that came out recently in the Sunday Times. I think it was just, I think it was just August 11th. It was recently in the UK, just talking about how epidemic this problem is and, just the impact that it has had and is having on young people in terms of what they're into sexually. So I think it's fair to say that, internet pornography is changing the way young people have sex and what their arousal template is and what they consider standard sexual practices, because they're embracing, you know, the ideas in pornography much more readily than they ever were.
Let's talk about pornography for maybe when we get back from our break, we could talk a little bit about pornography. I'm interested in your ideas. Are there any pros to pornography, or
what
are the cons?
I think there are a lot of pros to it, and it's just like everything on the internet. It's just an extraordinary tool that we have, and it can all be incredibly lurid and dark as well. I think pornography has given us a lot of sexual liberation in terms of seeing all the different ways in which people have sex and making people feel less isolated or less odd or unusual because of what their preferences are. And so for that, it's really been a part of what I've been saying of this new sexual revolution now for some time. We've broken a lot of constraints about what's normative, for example.
Well, let's get back to that. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be talking about pornography when we get back. We have with us Dr. Alexandra Katahakis, an expert in sex addiction and sexuality. And this is Dr. Michael McGee, The Well Mind with Dr. Mike Show. And please stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Well Mind with Dr. Mike Show. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. And we are very privileged to have with us today Dr. Alexandra Katahakis, the founder and clinical director of the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles, California. Welcome back, Dr. Katahakis.
Thank you.
We were talking before the break about pornography, and this is a highly loaded topic for many people. A lot of people feel that pornography is just purely bad and unwholesome. You were saying beforehand that there might be possibly some benefits of pornography. Can you tell us a little bit more about the pros and cons of pornography?
Well, I was saying earlier that I think the pros are that it can be an effective marital aid for people if they agree to the type of pornography they want to watch and the amount they watch and how it enhances their arousal versus becoming a stand-in for each other. So like anything, like whether you're using alcohol or marijuana to increase your pleasure, if it's, you know, on occasion and it's something that's agreed upon between two people, it's your life and it's your business. I think things get out of hand when they start to become addictive or compulsive. And all too often people, you know, want to name pornography strictly bad. And so I think we have to be careful of that and saying, look, it does help a lot of people in those ways. It helps people in their relationships, their arousal. It also helps people feel like they aren't unusual or weird or something's wrong with them if they have a certain sexual preference. And I am talking about preferences that involve consenting adults, not children or animals or anyone who cannot consent. And so in those ways, coming out of isolation, feeling more normative, finding a tribe of people that practice the kind of maybe kink or fetish that you're into can all be really helpful to people to have what they consider a healthy sex life. Where I think it becomes problematic is what I was talking about earlier, is the age in which children are looking at pornography, how that impacts the developing brain, and how it impacts their ideas about sex, especially when it comes to painful and violent images, body image issues about penis size, vagina size, breast size, and all these other sort of Hollywood, and I shouldn't blame Hollywood, but the world of pornography's idea, this make-believe world of sex and sexuality, which is sort of superhuman on some level and not how most bodies look or how most bodies work.
Right. Are there other negative aspects of pornography? Let's say you have a young man who are using pornography to gratify their sexual urges. Is there something negative about that or unwholesome about that from your perspective?
Well, I think it's problematic when young women start to consider that standard practice are expressions of misogyny. So meaning that they think it's okay for a male to ejaculate on their face on a first date, or that painful and violent expressions like punching a female in the face or pushing her out of a car, humiliation and, slapping, choking, things of that nature are just sort of normative sexual practices, because that doesn't have anything to do with sex. Sex is a bonding experience. It's an experience, a deep expression of intimacy, and to relegate it to these excessive, what I'm calling expressions of monogamy, because I don't know what else to call it, I think is deeply problematic for girls and boys who don't have any idea about what it means to connect with another human being.
Yes, that's a good point. Yes. You know, I'm mindful from my own spiritual practice and background that really the thinking of the ideal of sex as the combination of sensual pleasure with a deep emotional connection combined with a spiritual connection. And there is a lot of wisdom in the world's spiritual traditions of really refraining from sex without love. And I think of pornography as sex without love. I don't know, is that too moralistic? Tell us about your idea of what is healthy sex, and does pornography somehow fit into the picture that you have of healthy sex?
Well, I want to be very careful here, because I try not to take a moral stand about sex between consenting adults, because I think everybody has their own ideas about what healthy sex is, and I think it's important for each individual to determine what that is for themselves based on their own integrity, which is comprised of their values and their morals and their spiritual or religious ideas. I talk about this in two of my other books, Erotic Intelligence and Sexual Reflections, which is a workbook companion to Erotic Intelligence. But people have to decide what's true for them. What does sex leave you feeling good about yourself? Is it additive? Is it life-affirming? Or do you feel disgusting, gross, dirty, or like you've shamed or violated or abused yourself or someone else afterwards? So each person has to come to terms with that for themselves, and whether or not pornography fits into that for them is dependent, again, on who they are and what they want for their lives. So I would agree in part with what you're saying. I think when people are deeply connected to each other, that the erotic arises out of that novelty. It arises out of an open-heartedness as opposed to just genital-to-genital contact, which tends to be more pornographic, because it's just about two bodies getting off. And you can do that with anybody. You can do it with a stranger. You can do it with a vibrator. There's nothing emotionally connected about that. It might be fun. It might feel really good. But at the end of the day, when, you know, engaged in excessively, it's going to leave the person feeling empty inside and like they need something more and all the criteria that we talked about in the beginning. So when people ask me, what is healthy sex, my question in return is, well, what is healthy sex to you? Because what it is for you is different than for what it is for me or somebody else.
Well, well said. Absolutely well said. I'm reminded of a recent piece that I wrote on sort of clarifying between gratification versus fulfillment, and really can you see sex as a way to achieve a deep and profound fulfillment, or is it merely just scratching an itch and a sort of a sensual gratification, which maybe is not necessarily bad per se, but if that's all that you have, then that leaves you with an emptiness and a lack of.
Can I just ask you about that? Did you say gratification versus development?
Versus fulfillment.
Fulfillment. Okay, I was hard to hear that.
Oh, yes. Gratification versus fulfillment. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as an addiction psychiatrist, one of the things that I'm concerned about is numbing pain with pleasure and seeking sensual gratification as a substitute for the fulfillment of loving. It's something that we all have to sort of manage, where we don't fall into the trap of compulsive gratification as a substitute for the fulfillment of love.
Right. I think that's really well put, and I love how simple that notion is also. That simple notion that you've laid out has very deep not just ramifications, but deep ways for people to start to think about that. Like, what am I really doing? Because if I eat an entire chocolate cake, that's about gratification. Am I going to feel fulfilled afterwards? No, I'm probably going to feel really sick afterwards, right? And worse than I felt when I started that endeavor.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Katahakis, this is wonderful. We have Dr. Katahakis, Alexandra Katahakis with us. And we're talking about sexual addiction. This is Dr. Michael McGee with the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Please stay with us. We'll return to talking about sex addiction after the break. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. We have with us Dr. Alexandra Katahakis, who is the director of the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles, California. Welcome back, Dr. Katahakis.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to move on and ask you, what do you think about the culture that we live in? I personally feel we live in a very addictogenic society. But what part does our culture play in sex addiction?
Well, I think it plays a huge part. And increasingly, I have to say, every day I wake up and I look at the news and my head just spins. Because there's so much information and so much coming at us, and it feels like it's harder and harder to tell what is reality and what isn't about anything. And I'm reminded also every day that we live in a capitalistic society. So everything is about selling us our ideas, our identity, our sexuality, what's okay, what isn't. It all feels like it's in service of selling more product, whatever it might be. So, for example, I'm seeing an increasingly number of men that are having penile enhancement surgery to make their penises bigger because they are complaining that all, and I would say across the board with a few anomalies, they generally report that their penis size erect is 5 inches, which we know is average. That's right in the middle of the bell curve. But what we see in pornography is, you know, abnormal when we're looking at penises that are, you know, 9, 10, 12, I think 14 is the largest on record, inches. And they say they're not really comparing themselves to porn. They just want to feel better than by themselves or about themselves. And this is the same thing women report when they're increasing their breast size through implants. I just want to feel better. So we're selling self-esteem by way of implants. The idea that we're going to be better lovers because we have bigger breasts or bigger penises is a function of the culture that we live in. And that might be slightly tangential, but my point is that a lot of what sex addiction is socially constructed. So there are the early infantile and later childhood traumas that influence a human being. But then we're all swimming in the waters of this culture that says you're not sexy enough, you're not smart enough, have enough money, what have you. And you can conceivably get that by having more sex, by buying more things, by constructing yourself in a peculiar way, altering your body, being a sex object, and then that will make you happy. It's always that some other thing is going to make you happy outside of yourself. So these are the things that we're up against. And again, as I said, that we see that consumers of pornography are young people, very young people. So we're shaping the way that people have sex now more than ever before. And I don't know if that's going to lead us to more sex addiction or that we're all just going to be having sex in wide and varied ways with no rules or values or regulations on it.
Well, that brings us a question. Do you think that fidelity or monogamy is the future, or do you think that we're moving towards polyamory or more sexual society? Where do you see things moving?
I think we're in a great experiment right now, and with the advent of more people talking about polyamory or open relationships, especially people in their 20s and 30s are trying these designer relationships or different configurations, so what's called consensual non-monogamy. We won't know until we get through probably a generation, like 10 years of that, to see how that shakes out. But I think there are people that are much more naturally monogamous who seek that secure attachment, that want a family unit for the purposes of security and safety that will continue to seek monogamous committed relationships. And then there are others who either don't want that or don't have the capacity for that. And I'm worried about that statement because it's a little bit judgmental, but I do have a bias that intimacy, close-in, long-term monogamy requires an unbelievable amount of work. You know, it's not the happily ever after story. That's somewhat of a myth. It's really the buckle your seatbelt because this is going to be a really difficult story. You're going to go through trials and tribulations. You're going to wonder why you married this person. Some days you're not going to like them at all. Other days you're going to feel like you just don't know how you would function without them. This is what it means to be in a family and to be loyal and commit to another person. And that is not for the weak, for sure. That requires that we look at our own issues, I think, quite vigilantly. Because I always tell people, if you don't want to have any issues, live alone, right? Or live in a polyamorous relationship where you don't have to account to one person about everything all the time. If you live by yourself, nobody's going to tell you that you're annoying or that you're difficult or that you have issues, whether it's anger issues or impatience issues or cleanliness issues. You'll have no problem, but you'll be isolated. So it's hard to predict where we're headed, but it's hard for me to believe that that monogamy will just completely fall by the wayside.
Right. I mean, what you're implying, I think, is perhaps there might be some virtues of monogamy, and that perhaps there might be some benefits and rewards of monogamy that people would realize either emotionally or perhaps even spiritually that they may not possibly realize in a polyamorous relationship.
I would agree. It's like you can't have it both ways. I mean, I'm very, very interested in my monogamous committed marriage, very interested in it, because there's no way for me to know what the benefits are of it unless I stay in it. And if I leave it, I'd probably end up going and trying to figure that out with somebody else all over again. Someone else might say, yeah, but then you don't know what it's like to have a polyamorous relationship where you have, you know, multiple partners, two or three other partners that you get to love and have sex with over time and get to know. And that's true. You can't live in Paris and live in Los Angeles at the same time. You have to pick one. And you won't know the benefits of one or the other unless you get in deep. And I think that's true with any commitment. The only way to know if you want to do something or try something is you've got to commit to it and go the distance. You know, you can sit around reading books about golf, for example, your whole life. But if you never get on the course and play golf and dig into what's required of that, you won't ever really know what that's like. It'll just be some fantasy or some idea.
I'm reminded of a friend of mine whose father father was another man that she had a lifelong affair with while she was married. And she maintained both relationships for 40 or 50 years.
Wow.
in a committed way to both people. So there are some people who find this way to have, this was obviously not consensual, it was discreet, but she managed to fulfill some of her needs by maintaining two relationships. Very interesting to think about the way that people find ways to love and to get their needs met.
Yeah. Did the men know about each other?
No, not
to
the end. Not
she did it in secret for 40 years?
Toward the very end, they found out. But no,
wow.
She kept it secret. Very interesting. Well, we have Dr. Alexandra Katahakis with us talking about healthy sexuality and sexual addiction. This is Dr. Michael McGee, the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. We have with us Dr. Alexandra Katahakis. She is the director of the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles. Welcome back, Dr. Katahakis.
Thank you, Mike.
Let me ask you, how do people stay connected in healthy, sexy ways in long-term relationships over time?
Well, I think that requires an incredibly intentional commitment to one another. It's about staying in communication with each other, so talking to each other. I'm still sort of thinking about this woman who had these two relationships for 40 years and nobody knew about anybody. I was thinking about the amount of energy it took for her to hide all of that and how her partners never really knew her because she had this tremendous secret from both of them. And so I think in a healthy, committed sexual relationship over time, it requires great transparency to be able to sit down with your partner and to say, I'm struggling, or I don't feel sexually attracted to you, or I'm angry at you, so I don't want to have sex with you, but I miss you. I miss my friend. I miss my lover. I miss what we once had. And the act of being honest, rigorously honest, not mean or cruel, but honest with myself in relation to my partner is part of what creates novelty and infuses novelty in the system. Because in that conversation, inherent in it is the threat of loss. It's the threat of leaving. It's the threat or the, and not in an ultimatum way, but the possibility of, sometimes I wonder whether this is the right relationship for me or not. Sometimes I think about what it would be like to be with somebody else or to be on my own. And if you can't share that with your partner in a constructive conversation, then there's going to be a breach in the honesty, and there's self-deceit there also. So those conversations can often have a lot of grieving to them, a lot of sadness, because this is where we've come to, and this is where we're at, and what are we going to do? Where do we go from here? How do we change this? What do I need? What do you need? How do we help each other move towards having a preferred life? And all too often, I think all of us are guilty of just assuming that things are working well on autopilot, and then they're just going to kind of roll along until the day we die, as opposed to, you know, a conscious commitment to be in this marriage on this day, and where are we going from here? What do we want our life to look like? How does that relate to having children, children launching? What do the next, we want the next year or two or five to look like? And I think people have to dream together and imagine together and even make vision boards together about where are we headed. And it's hard to figure that out, especially when we're bogged down into what I call big adulthood, when you've got big responsibilities of work and, you know, kids and aging parents and mortgages and all the things that go with that. We no longer have the freedom of throwing on a backpack and going to Europe for 3 months. So those responsibilities can really create a lack of feeling sexy or desirable when you just feel like a worker and a householder.
Yeah, so if that's going on and you're saying that there's something about connecting with each other in an authentic and transparent way about your feelings and about really creating that emotional intimacy as a foundation for healthy sex, is that right?
Yes, I would say so. I believe that the erotic comes from a tremendous heart opening, from a deep, deep honesty with oneself and with the other. And it's through that heart opening, that connection with the other, you know, through our eyes, that our genitals naturally get aroused, because the arousal system, the sympathetic nervous system, is the excitatory system. And so when we are aroused by our partner's honesty, when we see them for who they are, for who we fell in love with, our whole system gets excited by that. So it's not just the genitals. Our hearts are open first, and we know that the brain is the largest sex organ in the body. And I think the brain is certainly excited first, and it takes the genitals almost a full 2 seconds to catch up with the brain. Now, 2 seconds is a long time in the world of neurobiology.
Yes, it's a long time. That's right. And what you're saying, if one is truly intimate and authentic, moment to moment, there's always novelty because things are always changing in terms
right.
of what we're experiencing and who we are, moment to moment. So that maintains a sort of emotional novelty that I would imagine, leads to sex being a fresh experience over and over again.
It does, and I think that's the thing about eye contact that is so simple and beautiful and powerful, is that the infant, this is where we started our conversation, is seeking the mother's eyes. The mother's eyes and her face are the most novel thing in the universe to that infant, and it's that novelty that's growing its brain and nervous system. And likewise, when we gaze into our lover's eyes, when we see them in close proximity, let's say, you know, 2 feet away, not 20 feet away, and we're really looking deeply, and they're looking back, we go through a whole lot of feeling states in that moment. We see them as young and old, as, you know, beautiful, as odd, as sexy, as the parent of our children, and all of those things. The universe largely exists in their eyes, and it's that that we love. It's some reflection of our very own self on some level where there's no duality and no personality of you or me, or I don't like the way you cut the cantaloupe. All of that falls away, and then we are deeply connected, and you could call this a spiritual experience.
I would call it that. I think that that experience is sacred.
Yeah.
And experiencing the sacredness of our oneness with each other in that moment is a very powerful force for all aspects of loving, including sexual expression, I think.
And I think addicts are looking for that experience. Certainly sex addicts are. You know, so many men I talk to over the years, 20 years of this conversation, and those who hire sex workers, so many of them go for one reason only, and that's for validation. They want to be seen. They want to be heard. They want to be known. Sometimes they don't even bother having sex. They cuddle and talk. And so that deep desire to be seen is at the core of all human beings. And that's what we're all looking for. That's what addicts are looking for. They're just looking for it in the wrong direction.
Yes, that underlying desire to see and be seen, to matter to others and have others matter to us. It's so, so profound. Beautifully said. Let me ask you, I'm curious, what percentage of people with sexual, I don't use the word addict anymore, but people suffering from sexual addiction, what percentage are men, what percentage are women, and how is sexual addiction different in men and women?
Well, it's difficult for me to give you the exact percentages because we don't really know how many people identify with having sexual addiction or compulsive sexual behaviors, but I can tell you clinically we see far more males, heterosexual males, coming into treatment than women. And I think that's because there's less stigma still for men than there are for women, you know, who have this problem. And men also tend to want to come in and get to the bottom of something and get to a solution and get on with it, whereas women really are quite violated when their trust is violated, especially if they've been sexually abused as children. So it's harder for them to admit that they have this particular problem. They generally won't call it sex addiction. They'll talk about having relationship issues or love problems. So I think it's really about the stigma still between men and women getting treatment.
Okay. That, yeah, thank you for that. Well, Dr. Cadahack, it's been wonderful having you on the show. I wonder if you could help tell our audience about the different books that you have written and how people can reach you.
Well, you can find all of my books on Amazon.com if you type in my last name. You can also find me at Center for Healthy Sex. So it's, the URL is centerforhealthysex.com, and all of that is spelled out. And all of my books are on that website. So the first book we talked about was Sex Addiction as Affect Dysregulation, and Erotic Intelligence, which came out in 2010, which is for people in recovery from sex addiction. Then I co-wrote a daily reader called Mirror of Intimacy, which is a daily meditation book on sex and sexuality. And finally, last year or so, I wrote a workbook for people in recovery called Sexual Reflections, and it's a workbook for designing and celebrating your sexual health plan.
So it is possible to have healthy sex in recovery from sex addiction, thanks to the work that work that you're doing with people. Thank you so much for all that you do.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation with you.
Oh, this has been great to have you. You've been listening to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee here, and we've been privileged to have Dr. Alexandra Katahakis as our host, the founder and clinical director of the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles. Dr. Katahakis, thank you so much for joining us and for privileging our readers with all of your wisdom and experience, our listeners, I mean, with all your wisdom and experience.
My pleasure. Thank you.